In the following recording by the LA Sound Posse, you will first hear Martin J. Sherwin, professor of history at Tufts University, present the 2006 William and Myrtle Harris Distinguished Lecture in Science and Civilization, titled Oppenheimer's Legacy, Science and Government in the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons. The talk was given at Beckman Auditorium at Caltech in Pasadena, California, on February 1st of 2006. Professor Sherwin and co-author Kai Bird wrote American Prometheus, The Triumph and Tragedy of J. Robert Oppenheimer. The talk is followed by a panel discussing the historical and ethical ramifications of the creation of the atomic bomb. We join Professor Jed Buchwald, who will introduce Professor Sherwin, and later the panelists.
Well, tonight's program is in two parts, and it begins with a presentation by Martin Sherwin, who's professor of history at Tufts. We'll then continue with a panel discussion afterwards. Martin received his BA from Dartmouth College and his PhD from UCLA. And in 1987, he published a wonderful book, A World Destroyed, Hiroshima and the Origins of the Arm Race. He's the general editor of the Stanford Nuclear Age series, and most recently published together with Kai Bird the highly acclaimed biography of J. Robert Oppenheimer, which he's going to speak about tonight. It's a wonderful book. Very intense biography of Oppenheimer and of the early nuclear age, and he's going to be talking about various aspects of it. So please join me in welcoming Martin.
Thank you very much. Thank you. It's a great pleasure to be here. Before I begin my talk tonight, I want to acknowledge my friend Kai Bird, who was the co-author of American Prometheus, on which my talk this evening is based. On July 16th, 1945, at 5:30 in the morning, following a stormy night, a light brighter than a thousand suns illuminated the desert 100 miles south of Los Alamos, New Mexico. A plutonium bomb, dubbed the Gadget, exploded with a force of 20,000 tons of TNT. That successful test marked a great divide in human history. On the far side was almost 10,000 years of war and peace, degradation and progress, in sum, the fantastic evolution of human existence. On the near side was a new incredible fact. It would soon be possible for the human species to destroy itself. It was as if that explosion in New Mexico desert, had suddenly shifted an active volcano under all of human existence. Mount Vesuvius and Pompeii was suddenly metaphors for the new world. In 2006, that nuclear volcano appears less active than it was in either 1986 or certainly than in 1962, the year of the Cuban Missile Crisis. But it remains active nevertheless, and we ignore its dangers at our peril. The physicist J. Robert Oppenheimer perceived those dangers on that fateful morning of July 16, 1945. My talk this evening centers on his efforts, alas, his failed efforts, to convince the government of the United States that in the long run, a decision to rely on nuclear weapons would bring far more danger than protection to this country. No single person can sensibly be credited or blamed for creating the nuclear age. But from among all of the engineers, scientists, politicians, military personnel, and corporate leaders who supported the construction, funding, and operations of the Manhattan Project, as the wartime atomic bomb program was codenamed, Oppenheimer stands out. Indeed, as the director of the wartime Los Alamos Atomic Bomb Laboratory, he was benighted in the glow of the Trinity test as the father of the atomic bomb. We don't know what Oppenheimer said or thought at the moment the gadget exploded, but he later claimed that upon seeing the initial flash, a passage from the Hindu scripture, the Bhagavad Gita, came to mind. I have become death, destroyer of worlds. We knew the world would not be the same, he also recalled in characteristically understated tones. A few people laughed, a few people cried, most were silent. Actually, most of the observers cheered, whooped, and yelled at their successful test. Just 5.5 years after the discovery of nuclear fission, Robert Oppenheimer, at the age of 41, had successfully led a team of scientists in building the world's first atomic bomb. By virtue of his personality, his brilliance, and his adept directorship of the Los Alamos Weapons Laboratory, Oppenheimer emerged from the war as one of America's most celebrated scientists. Born in 1904 in New York City, Robert Oppenheimer's life was shaped by his active participation and his engagement with three revolutions: the domestic revolution precipitated by the Depression and the New Deal, the international revolution led by Lenin in Russia, and the scientific revolution guided by the work of Einstein, Bohr, and Heisenberg. Educated at the Ethical Culture School, Harvard University, Cambridge University, and the University of Göttingen in Germany, he earned his PhD in theoretical physics in 1927 under the direction of Max Born. In 1929, issuing an offer from Harvard, he accepted an unusual appointment that had divided his time between the University of California, Berkeley, and Caltech, then a relatively new university founded less than four decades earlier. During the next 14 years, he helped to fashion UC Berkeley into the world's foremost center for theoretical physics and contributed to Caltech's rising prominence. Oppenheimer began his academic career as an apolitical intellectual. He was deeply engaged with physics, but he was also a serious student of the arts, languages, and literature. He read the French poets, and he learned to read the Bhagavad Gita in the original Sanskrit. But gradually, the impact of the Great Depression and the rise of fascism in Europe kindled an interest in domestic politics and international affairs. Once involved, he became a leader within the political activist community in the San Francisco Bay Area. Many of his friends were members of the Communist Party, and he supported causes championed by the California Communist Party, including the desegregation of public facilities, better working conditions for migratory farm workers, and the cause of the Republican Loyalists in the Spanish Civil War. During the years 1937 to 1942, he gave several thousand dollars through the party to support these causes. For nearly 4 years, he was engaged to marry Jean Tatlock, a medical student and a member of the Communist Party. But Jean refused to marry Robert. In 1940, he met and married another man's wife, Catherine Puning Harrison, a vivacious, sharp-tongued young woman. Kitty, as she was called, had once been married to Joe Dallet, a Communist Party official killed in the Spanish Civil War. During their married years, Kitty, too, had been a party member. Robert's younger brother, Frank, and Frank's wife, Jackie, were party members, as were many of Oppenheimer's friends and students. After World War II, these associations would be used by Oppenheimer's critics to call his loyalty into question, despite the fact that it could never be proved, and Oppenheimer always denied that he had been a member of the Communist Party. The discovery of nuclear fission in 1938, December 1938, and the outbreak of the war in Europe less than a year later, drew Oppenheimer, along with many other members of the physics community, into a presumed desperate race against Germany for the atomic bomb. In 1942, despite the opposition of security officers, General Leslie Groves, the military officer in charge of the Manhattan Project, appointed Oppenheimer director of the Los Alamos Nuclear Weapons Laboratory. Under his inspired leadership, atomic bombs were ready and used on August 6th and August 9th, 1945. The atomic fires that allegedly hastened the end of the war marked Oppenheimer's triumphant and transformative moment. He had devoted himself totally to achieving it. He had been a magnificent and uniquely effective scientific leader, and there is no doubt that it was Oppenheimer who made it possible to have two atomic bombs ready for delivery in August of 1945. To his colleagues, he appeared exhilarated by his success, but his wife knew better. In the days after Hiroshima, Oppenheimer plunged into a deep depression. Kitty told her friend Jean Backer, "You just can't imagine how terrible it's been. Robert was just definitely beside himself." Baca was struck by Kitty's emotional state. She was just afraid for what was going to happen given the terrible reaction he had, Baca said. The enormity of what had happened at Hiroshima and Nagasaki had affected Oppenheimer profoundly. Why did he have this reaction? In too many respects, for his humanistic soul, Oppenheimer had made the bombings possible. He had not just consented to them, he had not just directed their construction, but he had encouraged their use. He had participated in the targeting of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, the bullseye for each city being its center, not a military facility. He had been a member of two committees in which the use of the bomb was discussed. He could have said, no, don't use it, but he had consistently said yes. As the director of the Los Alamos Laboratory, he had stifled discussions related to whether it was appropriate to continue to work on the bomb after the surrender of Germany. He had prevented Leo Szilard's petition against the use of the bomb from being passed around Los Alamos to the other scientists. He did all of this believing that there was no alternative to using the bomb other than the invasion of Japan. That is what he had been told. But after the war, he learned differently. He learned that the invasion of Japan was months away, November 1st. He learned that the Japanese had raised the possibility of surrender as early as June, the main obstacle being the call for unconditional surrender that appeared to put the Emperor's life in jeopardy. He learned that clarification of the Emperor's status after the war would most likely have led to an earlier surrender, as Secretary of War Henry L. Stimson believed. He learned, too, that the Soviets had promised and planned, and did, in fact, come into the war before August 15th. And with their entry, there was virtual certainty that the Japanese would surrender. He learned from this experience that even an important scientific leader of an extremely important military project could be lied to and manipulated by his government. Within weeks, Oppenheimer began to voice his fears about the new weapon. During a visit to Washington, he told about half a dozen United States senators that there was no defense against nuclear weapons. And he spoke with the former vice president, Henry A. Wallace, who was now serving as Truman's Commerce Secretary. Afterwards, Wallace wrote in his diary, and I quote, "I never saw a man in such an extremely nervous state as Oppenheimer. He seemed to feel that the destruction of the entire human race was imminent. He complained bitterly that the Secretary of State, James Burns, felt that we could use the bomb as a pistol to get what we wanted in international diplomacy," unquote. Oppenheimer insisted that this would not work, Wallace continues in his diary. He says the Russians are a proud people and have good physicists and abundant resources. They may have to lower their standard of living to do it, but they will put everything they have got into getting plenty of atomic bombs as soon as possible. Wallace encouraged Oppenheimer, after hearing his views, to see President Truman. 6 days later, at 10:30 a.m. on October 25, 1945, Oppenheimer was ushered into the Oval Office. Before describing the Truman-Oppenheimer conversation, I want to turn your attention to the subtitle of tonight's event, Science and Government in the Nuclear Age. I am speaking this evening about a sliver of that enormous topic, a case study at the dawn of the nuclear age, a moment when a range of significant choices were available to our government. It was a time when roads not taken could have been, and in my view, and in Oppenheimer's, should have been taken. And I must remind you of this. Nothing in human history that flowed from decisions of governments has been inevitable. No historical event had to happen as it happened. The counterfactual is the essence of human intelligence. Alternatives have been and always will be available. To believe otherwise is the historical equivalent of intelligent design, an oxymoron if there ever was one. It is this fact that there are always alternatives that makes Oppenheimer's efforts to prevent a nuclear arms race still relevant. The Oval Office. Truman opened the conversation by asking for Oppenheimer's help in getting Congress to pass the May-Johnson bill, which would have given the military control over all things related to atomic energy. The first thing is to define the national problem, Truman said, then the international. Oppenheimer responded that in his view, it was the other way around. It would be best first to define the international problem. And he meant, of course, that the first imperative was to stop the spread of nuclear weapons immediately before it started by placing international controls over atomic technology. Truman, however, regarded the atomic bomb as a marvelous boon to America's power and did not share Oppenheimer's concerns. At one point in the conversation, Truman suddenly asked Oppenheimer to guess, "When do you think the Russians will get the atomic bomb?" Oppenheimer demurred. He said he wasn't sure. Truman said confidently, he knew the answer, never. For Oppenheimer, such foolishness was proof of Truman's limitations. The incomprehension it showed just knocked the heart out of him, the physicist Willie Higginbotham recalled. Finally, sensing that the president was not comprehending the deadly urgency of his message, Oppenheimer foolishly blurted, "I feel we have blood on our hands." The remark angered Truman, who by one account is said to have pulled out a handkerchief saying, "Wipe your hands." The meeting was over. Afterwards, Truman told Undersecretary of State Dean Acheson, "I don't want to see that son of a bitch in this office ever again." Even 6 months later, the encounter still vivid in his mind, he wrote Acheson and described Oppenheimer as, quote, "a crybaby scientist who had come to my office some 5 or 6 months ago and spent most of the time wringing his hands and telling me they had blood on them because of the discovery of atomic energy." Oppenheimer, who could charm almost anyone who he wanted to impress, had lost his cool. The enormity of the issue, his own political inexperience, the aura of the Oval Office, and Truman's ignorant statements had led Oppenheimer to panic. With that disastrous interview, he lost the ear of possibly his most important potential ally, the president. But Truman's interactions with scientists were never elevated. The president struck many of them as a small-minded man who was in many ways in over his head. Isidore Rabi said he was not a man of imagination. Nor were scientists alone in this view. John J. McCloy, Wall Street lawyer, said of Truman that he was a simple man, prone to make up his mind quickly and decisively, perhaps too quickly. Shortly after this encounter with Truman, Oppenheimer told an audience of scientists at Los Alamos that he was troubled by numerous official statements characterized by, quote, "an insistent note of unilateral responsibility for the handling of atomic weapons." Earlier that week, President Truman had given a bellicose Navy Day speech in New York Central Park that seemed to revel in America's military power. The atomic bomb, Truman said, would be held by the United States as, quote, "a sacred trust for the rest of the world," and, quote, "we shall not give our approval to any compromises with evil," unquote. Oppenheimer told his audience that he was not going to argue with the president's motives and aims. But, he said, "we are 140 million people, and there are 2 billion people on Earth. However confident Americans might be that their views and ideas will prevail, the absolute denial of views and ideas of other people cannot be the basis of any kind of agreement." In the spring of 1946, Oppenheimer was appointed to a presidential panel entrusted with the job of formulating a plan for the international control of atomic energy. The administration's heart was not in it, but the effective lobbying of Manhattan Project scientists, the scientist movement as it was called, had created public pressure for such an initiative, and the White House could not ignore that pressure. Oppenheimer soon persuaded his fellow panelists, including Truman's Undersecretary of State, Dean Acheson, to endorse a dramatic, comprehensive, and remarkably prescient plan. A simple international covenant banning atomic weapons was not enough unless people everywhere could be assured that it would be enforced. Neither was a regime of international inspectors sufficient. Oppenheimer's solution, which had evolved out of earlier conversations with Niels Bohr and Isidore Rabi, was to create an international agency that would monopolize all aspects of atomic energy and apportion its benefits as an incentive to individual countries. Such an agency would both control the technology and guide its development for strictly civilian purposes. He argued that in the field of atomic energy, all countries should agree to a partial renunciation of sovereignty. Not unlike, I should remind you, what the European Union, or what has occurred, what has been achieved among the members of the European Union today. Accordingly, the proposed Atomic Development Authority would have sovereign ownership of all uranium mines, atomic power plants, and laboratories. No nation would be permitted to build bombs, but scientists everywhere would be allowed to exploit the atom for peaceful purposes. In some updated and modified formulation, something like Oppenheimer's plan remains even today our best hope, our best long-range hope to avoid nuclear war. Not only do I believe this, but so does Mohammed El-Baradei, the director of the International Atomic Energy Agency. In 2003, El-Baradei proposed a major overhaul of the current nuclear regime that he believes is near collapse. El-Baradei's antidote is a proposal that is very similar to what Oppenheimer and his committee optimistically submitted to the White House 60 years ago in February 1946. It was called the Acheson-Lilienthal Report. Surely Oppenheimer believed with this plan, the president would now understand the urgency for controlling the atom. But as Oppenheimer's shadow spread across the stage upon which the debate over the role that nuclear weapons would play in American foreign policy, a darker shadow, that of J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI, hovered behind the scenes. That same week, Hoover was urging his agents to step up their surveillance of Oppenheimer. Though he hadn't a shred of evidence, Hoover suggested that Oppenheimer intended to defect to the Soviet Union. Simply assuming that Oppenheimer was a Soviet informant, Hoover reasoned that, quote, he would be far more valuable there and as an advisor in the construction of atomic plants than he would be as a casual informant in the United States. He instructed his agents to follow Oppenheimer's activities and contacts closely. This included illegal wiretaps on his telephone. Considering this from our vantage point today, it appears that Oppenheimer was living 60 years ahead of his time. Meanwhile, the Truman administration began to absorb the full import of Oppenheimer's proposals for an international atomic development authority. Secretary of State Burns made a pretense of saying he was favorably impressed. He was, in fact, shocked by the sweeping scope of the report's recommendations. And a day later, he persuaded Truman to appoint his long-term, that is Burns's long-term, business partner, Wall Street financier Bernard Baruch, to translate the administration's proposals to the United Nations. Dean Acheson was appalled by Baruch's appointment. Lilienthal wrote in his diary, "When I read the news last night, I was quite sick. When Oppenheimer read the news, he told a friend, 'We're lost.'" In private, Baruch was already expressing great reservations about the Acheson-Lilienthal report's recommendations. For advice, he turned to two conservative bankers and a mining engineer and close personal friend. Baruch, the mining engineer, and Secretary of State Burns just happened to be board members and investors in Newmont Mining Corporation, a major company with a large stake in uranium mines. Now, I'm not certain of this, but it's quite possible that Newmont Mining may have morphed into Bechtel, but we're still working on research on that. Not surprisingly, they were alarmed by the very idea that such privately owned mines might be turned over to an international atomic authority. Moreover, Baruch thought that the American bomb was, as he called it, a winning weapon. This attitude had come to dominate the Truman administration and ultimately American political culture. In many ways, it is the source of the arms race itself. Disregarding the opinion of most scientists, Baruch decided that the Soviets would not be able to build their own atomic bomb for at least 20 years. If so, there was no pressing reason to relinquish the American monopoly soon. Consequently, the plan he intended to submit to the United Nations would substantially amend, indeed fundamentally alter, Oppenheimer's Acheson-Lilienthal proposals. The Soviets would have to give up their right to a veto in the Security Council over any actions by the new Atomic Authority. Any nation violating the agreement would immediately be subjected to atomic attack. And before being given access to any of the secrets surrounding the peaceful uses of atomic energy, the Soviets would have to submit to a survey of their uranium resources. What Baruch was proposing was not cooperative control over nuclear energy, but a non-proliferation agreement designed to preserve the American monopoly of atomic weapons. Oppenheimer predicted for Lilienthal, quite accurately as it happened, exactly what would transpire. And this is a quote from Oppenheimer, as Lilienthal wrote it down in his diary. "The American disposition will be to take plenty of time and not force the issue in a hurry. Then a 10-2 report, Russia and Poland dissenting, will go to the Security Council, and Russia will exercise her veto and decline to go along. This will be construed by us as a demonstration of Russia's warlike intentions, and this will fit perfectly into the plans of that growing number who want to put the country on a war footing, first psychologically, then actually. The Army directing the country's research, red baiting, treating all labor organizations, CIO first, as communist, and therefore traitorous, etc., etc." On June 14, 1946, Bernard Baruch presented his plan to the United Nations, dramatically stating that he offered the world a choice between, quote, the quick and the dead. As Oppenheimer and everyone else associated with the original Acheson-Lilienthal plan predicted, Baruch's proposal was promptly rejected by the Soviets. Moscow's diplomats instead proposed a simple treaty to ban the production or use of atomic weapons. This proposal, Oppenheimer told Kitty over the wiretap telephone, was not too bad. No one could be surprised by Soviet objections to the veto provisions of the Baruch proposal. As Oppenheimer had predicted, the Truman administration rejected the Soviet response out of hand. Negotiations continued, but in a desultory manner, and no end came to it, no good end. An early opportunity had been lost to prevent an uncontrolled nuclear arms race between the two major powers. It would take the terrors of the 1962 Cuban Missile Crisis and the massive Soviet buildup that followed it before an American administration in the 1970s would propose a serious and acceptable arms control agreement. But by then it was too late. Tens of thousands of nuclear warheads had been built, and the so-called arms control regime became no more and no less than a collection of speed limits and traffic lights that guided the nuclear powers along the escalation highway. Later that summer, Lilienthal visited Oppenheimer in his Washington hotel room, and the two men spoke late into the night about what had happened. "As I left him," Lilienthal said, again from his diary, "that Oppenheimer replied, 'I am ready to go anywhere and do anything, but I am bankrupt of further ideas. And I find that physics and the teaching of physics, which is my life, now seems irrelevant. It was this last that really wrung my heart.'" And by the way, as Bob Christie will tell you a little bit later, this was the year that Oppenheimer was teaching at Caltech and have a very difficult time getting back into the classroom rhythm. Oppenheimer's anguish was real and personal. He felt a personal responsibility for these weapons of mass destruction. Every day, the newspaper headlines gave him evidence that the world might once again be on the road to war. "Every American knows that if there is another major war," he wrote in the Bulletin of Atomic Scientists in June 1946, "that atomic weapons will be used. We know this," and this is still Oppenheimer writing, "we know this because in the last war, the two nations which we like to think are the most enlightened and humane in the world, Great Britain and the United States, used atomic weapons against an enemy which was essentially defeated." Against an enemy which was essentially defeated. This was an extraordinary statement. Less than a year after the events of August 1945, the man who had instructed the bombardiers exactly how to drop their atomic bombs on the center of two Japanese cities had come to the conclusion that one of the most enlightened nations in the world, his own, had used atomic weapons against an enemy which was essentially defeated. A major war was not his only worry. Sometime that year, he was asked in a closed Senate hearing room whether three or four men couldn't smuggle units of an atomic bomb into New York and blow up the whole city. Oppenheimer answered, of course it could be done, and people could destroy New York. Well, a startled senator responded, what instrument would you use to detect an atomic bomb hidden somewhere in the city? Oppenheimer's reply, a screwdriver. And of course, what he meant was you need a screwdriver to open up every single box and case that you suspect. There was no defense, in other words, against nuclear terrorism, and he felt there never would be. A few years later, Oppenheimer persuaded the Atomic Energy Commission to have two physicists, Robert Hofstadter and Wolfgang Panofsky, write a report on the problem. The resulting top secret report recommended the installation of radiation detectors at all airports and ports. For a time, this was actually done in a few major airports. The Hofstadter-Panofsky report, known in the intelligence community as the screwdriver report, is still classified. Perhaps someone in the Office of Homeland Security has a classification high enough to read it. It would probably do them a lot of good. 4 years later, in the autumn of 1949, after the Soviets tested their own atomic bomb in August, Edward Teller lobbied furiously and effectively to escalate the nuclear arms race again by committing the United States to a crash program to build a hydrogen bomb, a fusion bomb that could be thousands of times more powerful than atomic fission bombs. The General Advisory Committee to the Atomic Energy Commission, of which Oppenheimer was the chair, was asked to consider this proposal. The GAC unanimously rejected the idea in the fall of 1949. The H-bomb was a weapon of genocide, they wrote, too large to have any military use. It was a city buster. Rather than enter a crash program for a hydrogen bomb, Oppenheimer and his colleagues proposed a program of sufficiency and arms control that was, as it turns out, 20 years ahead of its time. They pointed out that the large U.S. stockpile of atomic bombs were an adequate deterrent to anything the Soviets could build, even a hydrogen bomb. They recommended, too, that the Soviet achievement be used as an opening to discuss mutual assured stability by announcing a unilateral American policy not to build a hydrogen bomb, which, by the way, cannot be built without being tested and therefore detected. And they pointed out why such a policy provided more rather than less security. For nearly 5 years, Oppenheimer had tried to use his prestige and status as a celebrity scientist to influence Washington's growing national security establishment from the inside, and he had failed. Not until 1953, at the very height of the McCarthy era, did Oppenheimer begin to speak out publicly. He could not have chosen a more dangerous time. In a speech before the Council on Foreign Relations, later published that summer in the Council's journal, Foreign Affairs, this is 53, he railed against Washington's growing culture of secrecy. Secrecy in the atomic field, he charged, was leading to widespread rumor, speculation, and outright ignorance. We do not operate well, he said, when important facts are not known, in secrecy and in fear, and are only known by a few men. This cloud of ignorance, he said, sometimes envelops even well-informed men. Former President Harry Truman, for example, had recently disparaged the notion that the Soviets were developing a nuclear arsenal capable of harming continental America. Quote from Oppenheimer, it must be disturbing that an ex-president of the United States who has been briefed on what we know about the Soviet atomic capability can publicly call into doubt all the conclusions from the evidence. He also ridiculed a high officer of the Air Defense Command for saying only a few months ago that, quote, it was our policy to attempt to protect our striking force, but not really our policy to attempt to protect this country, for that is so big a job that it would interfere with our retaliatory capabilities. Unquote. Sounds like something out of Dr. Strangelove. Oppenheimer concluded that such, quote, follies can occur only when even the men who know the facts can find no one to talk about them, when the facts are too secret for discussion and thus for thought. The only remedy, Oppenheimer concluded, was candor. Officials in Washington had to start leveling with the American people and tell them what the enemy must already know about the nature of the atomic armaments race. It was an extraordinarily brazen speech in which Oppenheimer observed that he was barred from speaking of the essential facts, but that the essential fact was that no country could win a nuclear war. In the very near future, he said, we may anticipate a state of affairs in which the two great powers will each be in a position to put an end to civilization and the life of the other, though not without risking its own. And then, in a chilling phrase that startled everyone who heard it, Oppenheimer quietly said, we may be likened to two scorpions in a bottle, each capable of killing the other, but only at the risk of his own life. It's hard to imagine Oppenheimer making a more provocative speech. It seemed calculated to anger his fiercest critics, both in and out of government. Here was the father of the atomic era, declaring that the fundamental assumptions of the country's defense policy were laced through and through with ignorance and folly. Here was the nation's most famous nuclear scientist calling upon government to release closely guarded secrets. Here was a celebrated private citizen armed with the highest security clearance, openly discussing the nation's war plans and ridiculing them. As word spread through Washington's national security bureaucracy about what Oppenheimer has said, many were appalled and angry. Sitting in the audience that day was Louis L. Strauss, the man President Eisenhower had recently appointed chairman of the Atomic Energy Commission. A conservative Wall Street banker, Strauss was seething with anger. He was a devout believer in the American nuclear arsenal. Moreover, he knew Oppenheimer well, and he despised him. And Oppenheimer despised Strauss back. Since 1947, they had clashed repeatedly over large and petty issues. And by 1953, Strauss had decided that Oppenheimer might well be a Soviet agent. He had no evidence, but Oppenheimer's past left-wing associations and his opposition to the hydrogen bomb fed Strauss's suspicions, and Strauss shared his suspicions with FBI Director J. Edgar Hoover. But if he could not prove that Oppenheimer was a spy, Strauss nonetheless decided that Oppenheimer's influence and prestige constituted a threat to national security. And over the next year, in concert with Hoover, Edward Teller, and a like-minded protege named William Borden, Strauss orchestrated a campaign to strip Oppenheimer of his security clearance. In November 1953, Borden, with Strauss's encouragement, who was a former executive director of the Joint Committee of Atomic Energy, wrote a letter to Hoover, stating his suspicion that, quote, more probably than not, J. Robert Oppenheimer is an agent of the Soviet Union. As baseless as the charges were, they provided Strauss with the opportunity he had been waiting for to move against Oppenheimer. And on December 23, 1953, the Atomic Energy Commission, that is, Strauss, informed Oppenheimer that his security clearance was suspended. His former communist associations and his opposition to the hydrogen bomb were cited as evidence of his uncertain reliability. In April and May 1954, after a grueling six-week security hearing that was distorted by the Atomic Energy Commission's refusal to grant any of Oppenheimer's attorneys a security clearance, and therefore they had to leave the room when any classified information was discussed, leaving Oppenheimer without counsel. By illegal FBI telephone taps, not only on Oppenheimer, but on Oppenheimer's attorney's office, a biased hearing board declared in a 2-1 decision that Oppenheimer, though a loyal American, was nevertheless a security risk. His appeal to the Atomic Energy Commissioners was rejected, and in an effort to further embarrass Oppenheimer, Strauss insisted on publishing the confidential transcript of the hearing with the most damaging testimony highlighted for reporters. And since it's over 1,000 pages of very small print, the reporters appreciated that. In the long run, however, Strauss's strategy backfired. In the matter of J. Robert Oppenheimer, as the record of the hearing was called, revealed an inquisitorial character of the hearing martyred Oppenheimer and became a documentary record that exposed the corruption of justice during the McCarthy period. It should be required reading in our Patriot Act constructed world. In fact, the violation of regulations and due process was so outrageous that when Kai Bird and I brought them to the attention of the lawyers at the distinguished Washington law firm, Arnold and Porter, the firm decided to take the responsibility pro bono to have the hearing nullified, and that process is currently underway. So what were the consequences of that Star Chamber proceeding? For Oppenheimer, they were devastating. His friend Isidore Rabi had it right, I think, when he said it simply killed him. It destroyed him completely. And there were larger consequences, too. It removed a powerful voice, an important, intelligent, alternative view from the debate over the role that nuclear weapons should play in American policy. It led, as one political scientist wrote in a book entitled The Nuclear Question, to the pathetically uncritical view that, quote, we don't have the best of all possible worlds, but we have the best world possible. This is sometime in the 1970s, I think. The best world possible? Now, that's the sort of balderdash that the silencing of Oppenheimer led to. For a few years after World War II, scientists had been regarded as a new class of intellectuals, members of a public policy priesthood who might legitimately offer Washington their expertise, not only as scientists, but as public philosophers. But with the Oppenheimer verdict, all scientists were put on notice that dissenting views carried dangerous consequences. As the sociologist Daniel Bell later observed, Oppenheimer's ordeal signified that the post-war messianic role of the scientists was now at an end. Oppenheimer's defeat was also a defeat for American liberalism. Like many Roosevelt New Dealers, Oppenheimer had once been a man of the broad left, active in popular front causes. But having evolved into a liberal disillusioned with the Soviet Union, he had used his celebrity to slip into the ranks of the liberal foreign policy establishment, counting his friends, men like General George C. Marshall, Dean Acheson, and McGeorge Bundy. Liberals had then embraced Oppenheimer as one of their own. His humiliation thus implicated liberalism. For decades afterwards, liberal politicians were put on notice that questioning America's reliance on a nuclear arsenal was forbidden territory. More than 50 years later, our politicians still can't think clearly or speak to us critically about our own weapons of mass destruction. Oppenheimer tried to warn us of the folly of acting unilaterally in the nuclear era. He failed. And a half century later, our nation remains correctly fearful that nuclear weapons will one day be used again, perhaps against us. Oppenheimer, who died of throat cancer in February 1967, is long gone, but his shadow is still visible, and a nuclear Mount Vesuvius remains smoldering beneath. Thank you.
Thanks very much for a powerful and a depressingly familiar talk, given the present political circumstances. I'd like to invite the panelists to come up for an informal discussion. Let me introduce them one by one, so I'll bring you all up individually. First, of course, we have David Baltimore, professor of biology and president of Caltech. David. David is also president-elect of the American Association for the Advancement of Science and has long been actively involved in public policy issues. In the mid-70s, he played an important role in creating a consensus on national science policy regarding recombinant DNA research, and he's been an early advocate of federal AIDS research, co-chaired the 1986 National Academy Committee on the National Strategy for AIDS, and was appointed in 96 to head the National Institutes of Health AIDS Vaccine Research. I'd like now also to introduce Professor Robert Christie and welcome him up to the stage. Well, many former Caltech students and faculty served in various capacities as scientists and engineers during World War II, and Professor Christie is among those who played a significant role at Los Alamos. He's Professor Emeritus in the Division of Physics, Astronomy, and Mathematics at Caltech. An astrophysicist, Dr. Christie received his undergraduate and master's degrees from the University of British Columbia and his doctoral degree from the University of California. Now, during the Manhattan Project at Los Alamos, Christie's implosion design for the core alleviated instability problems and was actually the basis for the plutonium bomb. After Los Alamos, he worked at the University of Chicago and joined the California Institute of Technology, where over the past 50 years he served in many capacities, including professor, provost, and acting president. He was awarded the Eddington Medal of the Royal Astronomical Society in 1967. And last but not least, let me introduce our moderator for the discussion today, Walter Isaacson. Walter, can you? Well, Walter will certainly inject a considerable amount of liveliness into discussions among academics, and he's had a distinguished career in many, many fields. He's currently president and CEO of the Aspen Institute. He received a BA in History and Literature from Harvard and an MA in Philosophy, Politics, and Economics at Pembroke College of Oxford, where he was a Rhodes Scholar. He began his career in journalism at the Sunday Times of London and then the New Orleans Times, Picayune, States Item, joined Time Magazine in 1978 and was a political correspondent, national editor, and editor of New Media before becoming the magazine's 14th managing editor in 1996. He was chairman of CNN and is currently in the very difficult task of vice chairman of the Louisiana Recovery Authority. He's also on the board of directors of Tulane University, the National Constitution Center, and chairman of the board of Teach for America. Walter's the author of Kissinger, a biography, and most recently, a wonderful book, Benjamin Franklin, An American Life. So, Walter, I'll ask you to take over,
please. Thank you so much, Jed.
You were at Los Alamos with Oppenheimer, and then you become his successor here at Caltech. What was he like to work with?
Well, he was a dominating figure, as everyone knows. And he created an atmosphere among his students that caused them to essentially worship him. He was put on a pedestal, and they felt that he was everything. Mm-hmm. At Los Alamos, we did not have close contact with him in work. He was the director, and I was just doing some of the work. So the contact there, except socially, was not close. Mm-hmm. But the place ran smoothly, in spite of the fact that there were a large number of very distinguished and very independent scientists trying to work together on a program, and he got them to work together, which was an amazing accomplishment.
Now, do you feel there were any questions then, or should have been any questions about the morality of working on the bomb?
We didn't, for the most part, spend very much time worrying about the morality. We were worried about what we thought was a very likely possibility that Nazi Germany was developing a bomb and could well be ahead of us. And so that the strong motivation that we had was to get an atomic bomb before Germany did.
And how many of the scientists do you think afterwards shared some of the reservations that we heard about Oppenheimer having?
Most, I believe. Mm-hmm. Most of us, after the bomb was made and dropped, we then spent our time concerned with what have we done now? Mm-hmm. And there was almost, I would say, a complete hiatus in the development work on the bomb after the bombs were dropped, while people worried about the control of atomic energy, and generally supported the views put forward by Oppenheimer.
Mr. President, you've read Marty's book. And
I have.
I think you like it. But what resonance does it have for today, those type of issues?
Well, sometimes in reading the book, you feel like you're living the same questions. Eavesdropping without authority is defended by the president today. I can remember when so much was written about what J. Edgar Hoover had done, and we thought that maybe we had cleansed America of those kinds of attitudes, and they all seem back. the what one might call American hubris, the sense that America is the only place that matters, that we have a right to do whatever we feel is appropriate. You sense that in Marty's descriptions of President Truman, dismissing Oppenheimer, being unwilling to think about the moral dimension of what was happening. I mean, the story about blood on his hands, you say, and certainly history bears that out, that Oppenheimer made a huge mistake in allowing his feelings and what was obviously preying on his mind to come out at a moment like that. And yet the story really is in a way about Truman and his unwillingness to think in those dimensions. Today, I do think that a certain amount of what Oppenheimer thought looks naive. The internationalization sounds wonderful, and I think we all would like to believe in it, but the later behavior of the Soviet Union certainly puts a different perspective on the desires of the atomic scientist to see that the bomb was not further developed and that atomic energy was controlled in an international framework. So there's an awful lot to think about that really does relate to our world today.
Let me raise one issue that you haven't touched on that's very similar to the one, which is there research now that people are doing that they should just not do?
Not at Caltech.
No, I have actually written about that question in an article in Daedalus years ago, which they keep reprinting, just reprint again.
Well, you can update it. So.
Yeah. I don't think you can demarcate an area of research and say you shouldn't do X, you shouldn't do Y. I think too much of research is interdigitated. Too often, the critical piece of information comes from some kind of left field. If you either do research or you don't do research, but to say that there are things you don't want to know, I don't think works at all well in any practical sense. The people who set the basis for atomic energy were not thinking about bombs. They were trying to understand basic physics. There would have been no way around the discovery of the capability to make a bomb.
If there were new capabilities to make new type of weapons, like nuclear weapons, would you want it done by yourself or your professors that you work with?
Would I want the research done?
Yeah.
Well, people argue that in developing molecular biology, we are developing those capabilities.
That's where I was going to go.
Right. That's what it sounded like. And it's true. I mean, the ability to manipulate living organisms that we have developed and are continuing to develop has as one of its spin-offs, if you wish, the ability to create organisms of a new kind of potential, the ability to spread, the ability to cause disease, the ability to elude the immune system. And we have to keep control over those things. And I fundamentally believe that the scientific community has the responsibility to think about those things, to bring out those implications as early as possible. And I was involved in an activity like that in the very early times when the first recombinant DNA capabilities became evident. And it was the scientists who led in what's called the Asilomar meeting in Asilomar, California, to raise the issues of the potential danger that could come out of that kind of research. But I don't think that the right answer is to say there's certain things you don't want to do, because it's exactly the same research that gives us the tremendous power we have to deal with disease today.
Marty talked about the notion of trying to control the bomb after the war and what a bad mistake it was that we didn't find a way to control it. I wanted to tout, if I could, because Diana Buchwald put this together this afternoon. I had the joy of being at something that really is a crown jewel at Caltech, which is the fact that you have Albert Einstein's archives here and the Archives Project. And there was a wonderful exchange of letters, which even Marty hadn't seen, buried in this thing, if you go through the archives, and I'd recommend it, between Oppenheimer and Einstein, where Oppenheimer is proposing this sort of Acheson-Lilienthal thing, and Einstein says, no, you can't really do that until you have a sort of world federalist government. You need something grander. It's not just one weapon. Who was naive
Marty?
Well, I don't think it's a question of anyone being naive. I mean, this was a time when there were some real choices, and Einstein's idea was a much bigger idea. And interestingly enough, for a while, Edward Teller agreed with that, and then he went completely in the other direction. But Oppenheimer was working on something that was there in front of them and possible. The administration felt it was necessary to turn this over to this committee of the Undersecretary of State, Dean Acheson, the former director of the TVA, David Lilienthal, and several other distinguished and informed people. So they were coming up with a plan that, even though the administration reluctantly encouraged, still encouraged. So I think that that was a very practical thing. Now, the question is, we look back on the Cold War and we say, well, that wouldn't have worked anyway, because look what Russia did, and look at Stalin, and so on and so forth. But that's not the point. Oppenheimer understood that later on. He said, given what we know now, 5 years later, it's anybody's guess if any of this could have worked, and it probably couldn't. There's no reason to believe that Stalin. But by not doing it, we set a course, our own course, in motion in a direction that Oppenheimer and I certainly, and maybe a lot of the audience, disapproves of. We did not need to have the kind of arms race that we had, going off at the gun, Hiroshima, and going at full speed. I mean, Herb York himself wrote in a book that the United States promoted the arms race too fast, too quickly, with too many weapons. We were always trying to stay ahead. We had lots of opportunities to create what became arms control agreements, but they always came 10 years later than they had to.
Professor Christie, the great quote about scorpions in a bottle, the notion of an arms race, but scorpions in a bottle don't sting each other, and there hasn't been a subsequent use of nuclear weapons. Could you make the counter case that this is a force for stability instead of a force for instability, as Professor Sherwin said?
It seems to work both ways. Namely, it has been a force for stability over the last number of years because no one is willing to take the first step. On the other hand, particularly if nuclear weapons get into the hands of non-governments, but you might say terrorists, then no one knows, but presumably there's no stability in that at all. Mm-hmm. I don't think anyone trusts these days that you can maintain the current stability forever. Mm-hmm. You have to do something different.
What would you do? Pakistan has a bomb. Iran is about to have a bomb.
I don't think I've been in the position to really develop alternatives.
Okay.
Although I believe that our present path is not working.
I'm going to throw this out. These are from the audience now. Was a blow to Oppenheimer a blow to physics and science in general, as is the case currently? Was a blow to Oppenheimer a blow to physics and science?
Yes, blow to Oppenheimer was a blow to physics in general. I think it was a blow to open discussion about the issues that physicists were involved in related to war and peace. And it was one of the elements that made the Cold War and the McCarthy period so oppressive.
To get back to a question I've asked you, but is now made more specific by a member of the audience, there's an article in the Pasadena Star News about 8 years ago that reported on the start of a 10-year research project at Caltech to model nuclear explosions. What's the state of that research project, and isn't this something that the lessons of J. Robert Oppenheimer would cause us to question the purpose of this research project?
Well, first of all, it is an open research project, and its aims, as far as Caltech are concerned, are not to model nuclear reactions, but rather to develop the computer and mathematical capability to model complex situations. I'm being vague because the truth of the matter is that I haven't heard much about where that is at right now. I just don't know, so I can't say anything.
I certainly am not aware of any attempt to model anything like the detail of a nuclear explosion. There are certainly projects in trying to understand hydrodynamics from a computer point of view.
In retrospect, would you have done the things you did at Los Alamos and subsequently?
Yes, yes indeed.
Mm-hmm. Jed, I didn't realize, oh, sorry, go ahead.
I had a question since we're asking questions. Oppenheimer, in many ways, had a celebrity that very few scientists ever have. And I'm curious what you think are the roles of his magnetic and very forceful personality, his personal attractiveness, which you see in some of the pictures of him, a remarkable sense of personal style, which must have made him a personality to deal with that very rarely you see in a scientist, coupled with his very quick ability to speak and to analyze situations. Do you think that we'll see his like again?
That we'll see his likes again?
Yeah, his likes again.
I assume so, but I think, let me sort of turn the question a little bit and just say that the special qualities that he had were particularly interesting to Kai and to me because we saw these qualities develop over time. This was not a person who, as a young child, had all these qualities. Mm. In fact, here was a child whose brain was in overdrive, whose physical capabilities were stuck in first gear, who was awkward in almost every way possible, who was pampered at home like a pet poodle, who desperately wanted to be loved in the outside world the way his parents adored him in the home. And he was a mess. By the time he was 23 years old, he was contemplating suicide. And it was only through a powerful effort on his own part that he managed to transform himself into the extraordinary public persona that he was. And it was an amazing process to watch as a biographer and see this happen.
Professor Christie, he was successful at Los Alamos, awesomely so. Was it more because he was a great theoretical physicist, or was it because of the power of his personality, his celebrity, and his style that Marty just talked about?
It was both, really. That is, everyone respected him as a physicist. He was unusually quick, as been mentioned. He understood things immediately. But in addition, he had the personal charm so that he could convince other people that to work with him and for him. Mm-hmm. It was a combination.
And did his celebrity give him some power as well, or did he not have that celebrity until later in retrospect?
Later, really. He had a power to influence physicists at that time and other scientists, mm-hmm. but not the public, really.
Mm-hmm. A question, who, if anyone, well-known or otherwise, spoke up on behalf of Oppenheimer during the matter of J. Robert Oppenheimer?
Oh, lots of people. George Kennan, Vannevar Bush, Isidore Rabi.
Albert Einstein.
But he didn't appear at the hearing.
Leader
Briggs, Robert Bacher.
The people who spoke against him were a relatively small number. Some people from the Air Force. Lawrence was on his way from Berkeley, but then had a stomach attack of some kind and did not show up. Edward Teller, of course, was the main and most devastating witness against them. But for the most part, the science community supported Oppenheimer.
I was actually going to turn to Jed, who I didn't know you'd be on the panel, and you probably didn't know I was going to throw a question. But we flash forward when I talked to President Baltimore about the resonance it has today. But what resonance does this have in history? How often have scientists been put in these positions, whether it's Galileo and the Inquisition or whatever, where they feel they have to speak truth to political power or stand up to political power or are compromised by doing the biddings that they perhaps shouldn't have done?
Well, I can't think of anything that's really quite analogous to what's happened since World War I, which is really the first time that scientists were substantially engaged in military enterprises. But there certainly hasn't been a time since the middle of the 17th century when scientific work hasn't been deeply engaged with government in one form or the other. starting maybe most noticeably with the amount of money the British government and the French government put in the 18th century into figuring out how to determine longitude on Earth in order to guide the navies. And that actually generated quite a bit of scientific work, including novel discoveries in planetary dynamics and so on. On the other hand, I can't think of any situation in which scientists were actually engaged politically in anything like the fashion that's become common in the 20th century, and that's probably in major part because the scale is utterly and completely different, and the effects are totally different from what they ever have been before. So I don't think that there's anything analogous to it. I mean, historians, as you know, don't like to say, to do historical analogies. Everything's always different, but...
So why do we have you?
Right, well, to speak truth to power.
Oh, right, okay.
But it's certainly, and Marty has alluded to this, there are some striking analogies between the way the government behaves in the modern era between now and the early 1950s. David mentioned a number of things. Illegal wiretaps, difficulties in having scientists actually, and we've seen that recently in the last week with the head of the Goddard Institute, Professor Hansen. Not being allowed to speak scientific materials in public and so on. These kinds of things really seem to me to be strikingly novel since World War II. And you would have thought that they had been muted over the last 30 or 40 years, but they seem to be coming back with a vengeance these days.
David?
I fully agree with that. And the story of Oppenheimer in many ways is the story of the first time that the weight of the federal government came down on trying to silence a scientist from saying what he or she believed to be the truth. But we now see it on a daily basis.
You're talking about the global warming issue?
Global warming issue, the EPA, the environmental issues,
space,
just about anything that relates to science today seems fair game. I mean, the government has said that they don't want scientists going to international meetings to talk unless they get approval from their superiors.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we've never seen, this is government scientists. Mm-hmm. We've never seen anything like that. I mean, you used to put together a scientific meeting and you would say, well, I want to get this person from the FDA or this person from the NIH, and now the government wants to agree on who it is that is invited. To make sure that they're going to say follow the approved line. And in many ways, the trial of J. Robert Oppenheimer was the quintessential moment when the government asserted its authority to shut up scientists who were saying things that were inconvenient or against policy.
Do you worry about scientists getting into things, politicians and government getting into things like cloning or those type of ethical decisions?
You know, I actually believe that decisions that have a large moral component are very appropriate decisions for government involvement. You can't leave it to the scientists. I think there's some truth in that. And when you're looking for the center of gravity of American popular opinion about a topic, the way you get it is through the political process. I happen to believe that the decisions that have been made about stem cell biology and cloning are being made in the interests of a very small group of people, or relatively small group of people, who are dominating the thinking in Washington. I don't think it represents the feelings of the general population. It certainly doesn't represent California, where we took a vote on this issue, mm-hmm. and very came down 59 to 41 in favor of continuing stem cell research and therapeutic cloning. Mm-hmm.
Marty, it's a question about, I read a major reason the bomb was used, or the bombs were used, that so much money had been invested in their development that not to use them would have been unthinkable. I know that sounds laughable, but in some ways, at least according to what I've read, it was almost hard to say, no, let's not use them once it had been done. What are the, goes back to your previous book, A World Destroyed, but what do you think the reasons were that they dropped the bomb on Japan?
Well, there's a long list of reasons, and the debate among historians is really which is number one, two, et cetera. I mean, obviously, one reason is the war was still going on, and the bombs were ready. Another reason was that if the bombs are used against Japan, it'll be a warning to Russia to limit their ambitions in Eastern Europe and in the Far East. Henry Stimson, when he heard about the Alamogordo test on July 16th, he was in the Potsdam Conference at the time, got the news, and his remark was, now we have the great equalizer. And the great equalizer was the bomb is now equal to all those troops the Soviets have. Another reason was that we had invested a great deal of money, effort, time, you know, commitment into this project. It was at the time the most expensive project going. How are we going to defend not using it? And so on and so forth. You know, so my own view is that the bombs were not necessary to use. It was not necessary to use the bombs to end the war. The Japanese, we knew, were trying to surrender, but under terms, we were not willing to clarify the status of the emperor, and that was the standoff. The first bomb was dropped August 6, 1945. The emperor and his council were meeting on August 9th when the second bomb was dropped. The Soviets entered the war on August 8th, and the Japanese sued for surrender on August 10th. Was it the bombs? Was it the Soviets? They sued for surrender saying, on the condition that the emperor's life be spared or some other things about the emperor. And the United States, in effect, a little obliquely, but in effect, accepted that term. And that was the key point. So everything is all mixed up. And that gives historians the opportunity to write lots of books about it.
But not make historic analogies.
I mean, this is good business, you know? This is the way you want historical issues.
I think Cold War history has swung back and forth from revisionists and post-revisionists. And it all starts with, what do you feel were the reasons for dropping the bomb? Sort of starts a whole new school of history. Professor Christie, when you heard the bomb was dropped, you heard about Hiroshima, tell us what that was like, tell us what you thought at the time, and now tell us in retrospect whether you think it was good or bad that that bomb was, or justifiable or not justifiable, I guess I should say. It was clearly not good.
Prior to the dropping, I did not have a kind of a clear vision of the effects. We had calculated the effects, and in fact, the height of the burst was calculated in order to maximize the physical destruction, the destruction of buildings and things. After the bomb was dropped and I first saw pictures of Hiroshima, I was really horrified because this was a city flattened. And
were you in Los Alamos on August 6th when the bomb was dropped?
Yes.
And were you all watching it? Or, I mean, not you couldn't watch it, but I mean,
saw pictures in the paper.
Pictures come in or something?
Pictures in the paper. No, we didn't. Only we had to wait for newspapers.
Newspapers, yes. Accounts, but that's you right. Had radio accounts.
We were aware it had been dropped, that's about all.
Okay.
Yeah.
Go ahead.
And
so there wasn't a moment there where everybody is sort of holding their breath and waiting to see?
No.
You were at Alamogordo?
Yes.
Did Oppenheimer really say that about...
Not in my presence.
Okay. But what did you think, see and feel at Alamogordo when the test bomb is set off?
Well, I think most of us felt considerable elation that after all of this effort, it had worked, and apparently worked rather well. So we did not, most of us at that moment, were not thinking about the possible consequences. Mm-hmm. We were thinking merely that this is a project that had been successful. Later, I had occasion on a number of occasions to visit Hiroshima, and in connection with evaluating the effects of the bomb. This is over the last 20 years. And on those occasions, I visited the Hiroshima Peace Museum. And that brings to one very vividly the effects of the bomb on Hiroshima, much more so than I had before. And again, a realization that this is not the kind of way that we can wage war in the future. It's just not feasible to use thousands of such weapons. And how to avoid that is the issue now.
Do you think that Truman should have avoided it in August of 1945?
I am not in a position to judge him. Mm-hmm. I am in a position to say that every veteran that I've ever talked to who was in the Pacific and in line to invade Japan felt that tremendous relief that the bomb had been dropped. Mm-hmm. And I've also been convinced in viewing the intense resistance the Japanese put up in defending all of their islands and territory, that the loss to the Japanese, we had in fact invaded Japan, would have been far worse than the loss they suffered in the bomb. Mm-hmm.
Just let me follow up on that. It's important to understand that the debate among historians is not that it would have been better to invade than to use the bomb. No one I know, and certainly not me, argues that it would have been better to invade than use the bomb. The argument is, was there going to be an invasion? Was it even possible that the Japanese would have held out all the way until November 1st? There's a new book out by Hasegawa, who teaches at the University of Santa Barbara, called Racing the Enemy. It's a wonderful study that uses Soviet and Japanese and American archives about the decision to drop the bomb. And he comes to the conclusion, which I had come to a long time ago, that there was no question but that the Japanese would have surrendered about that time, sometime in August, once the Soviets came in. But we would have had to have modified, as we do, clarified the status of the emperor. Once those two things happened, the war was over. I totally agree. An invasion would have been an awful thing for the Japanese and the Americans.
One of the reasons that Stimson and some others did not agonize as much about the dropping of the bomb, and even Truman spends very, very little time agonizing over the decision, is that some people thought of the bomb as a bigger weapon, but not a totally different thing. It was not totally different than the firebombings. I mean, that the destruction caused by the firebombings of Tokyo, at least some of the politicians at the time, didn't realize we were entering an entire new nuclear age.
Not Stimson. No, Stimson understood what the scientists understood, that this was really different. And he wrote about this in memos and tried to get the president to understand that. But he still thought the bomb should be used because, and this was this incredible rationalization process, the world will not be willing to make the kinds of, governments will not be willing to make the kinds of commitments to international control, to surrender sovereignty in order to control nuclear weapons, unless they understand how horrible these things are. So using them, the argument went, will in fact increase the possibility that we will have an international regime to control nuclear weapons after the war. It was, you know, sort of one way of thinking. I mean, human beings are incredible. They can rationalize anything. And, you know, this was part of that process.
Well, it's a good note on which to end, since this is a citadel of rationalizing anything. But I don't mean it in that way morally.
Rationalizing and rational thought are two different things.
That's right. Thank you. Good point. Thank you to everybody in the panel.
You have been listening to Martin J. Sherwin, professor of history at Tufts University, presenting the 2006 William and Myrtle Harris Distinguished Lecture in Science and Civilization, titled Oppenheimer's Legacy, Science and Government in the Shadow of Nuclear Weapons. His presentation was followed by a panel discussing the historical and ethical ramifications of the creation of the atomic bomb. This event was held at Beckman Auditorium at Caltech in Pasadena, California, on February 1st of 2006. This program was produced by the LA Sound Posse. The LA Sound Posse records speeches and events dealing with social justice issues. We use the Creative Commons Attribution, Non-Commercial, Share-Alike 2.5 license to ensure the ongoing public availability of these recordings. We share them via the internet, community radio, and CDs distributed through grassroots, social justice groups, nonprofit organizations, committed individuals, and others. Our goal is to be a part of the creation of a broad-based, participatory, and democratic civic media in support of a truly democratic society. You can reach us on the web at www.lasoundposse.org. Contact us for copies of this program on CD. You can download it for free at radioforall.net. That's www.radio4all.net. If you value what you heard in this program, Please feel free to copy and distribute it to others who you think would benefit from hearing it, and thus becoming yourself a part of a decentralized, democratic, civic media.